Yeah, because we got a lot of people out there who we really want coming to help us right now, Amos said. Amos pulled himself into the narrow passage between the two hulls and then out of sight. Holden followed him in. 2 meters beyond the hatch loomed the blocky and complex-looking pump mechanism that kept water pressure to the maneuvering thrusters. Amos stopped next to it and began pulling parts off. Holden waited behind him, the narrow space not allowing him to see what the big mechanic was doing. "How's it look?" Holden asked after a few minutes of listening to Amos curse under his breath while he worked. "Looks fine here," Amos said. "Gonna swap this breaker anyway, just to be sure. But I don't think the pump's our problem." Shit, Holden thought. Holden backed out of the maintenance hatch and half-crawled up the steep slope of bulkhead back to the engineering hatch. The angry red light had been replaced with a morose yellow one, now that there was no atmosphere on either side of the hatch. "Naomi," Holden said, "I've got to get into engineering. I need to see what happened in there. Have you killed the safeties?" "Yes, but I've got no sensors in there. The room could be flooded with radiation."
"But you have sensors here in the machine shop, right? If I open the hatch and you get radiation warnings, just let me know. I'll shut it immediately."
"Jim," Naomi said, the stiffness that had been in her voice every time she'd spoken to him for the last day slipping a bit. "How many times can you get yourself massively irradiated before it catches up with you?"
"At least once more."
"I'll tell the Rosie to prep a bed in sick bay," she said, not quite laughing. "Get one of the ones that's not throwing errors." Without giving himself time to rethink it, Holden slapped the release on the deck hatch. He held his breath while it opened, expecting to see chaos and destruction on the other side, followed by his suit's radiation alarm. Instead, other than one small hole in the bulkhead closest to the explosion, it looked fine. Holden pulled himself through the opening and hung by his arms for a few moments, examining the space. The massive fusion reactor that dominated the center of the compartment looked untouched. The bulkhead on the starboard side bowed in precariously, with a charred hole in its center, like a miniature volcano had formed there. Holden shuddered at the thought of how much energy had to have been released to bend the heavily armored and radiation-shielded bulkhead in like that, and how close it had come to punching a hole in their reactor. How many more joules to go from a badly dented wall to full containment breach? "God, this one was close," he said out loud to no one in particular.
"Swapped out all the parts I can think to," Amos said. "The problem is somewhere else."
Holden let go of the rim of the hatch and dropped a half meter to the bulkhead, which angled below him, then slid to the deck. The only other visible damage was a hunk of bulkhead plating stuck in the wall exactly on the other side of the reactor. Holden couldn't see any way that the shrapnel could have gotten there without passing directly through the reactor, or else bouncing off two bulkheads and around it. There was no sign of the first, so the second, incredibly unlikely though it was, had to be what had happened.
"I mean really close," he said, touching the jagged metal fragment.
It was sunk a good 15 centimeters into the wall, plenty far enough to have at least breached the shielding on the reactor. Maybe worse.
"Grabbing your camera," Naomi said.
A moment later, she whistled.
"No kidding.
The walls in there are mostly cabling. Can't make a hole like that without breaking something." Holden tried to pull the shrapnel out of the wall by hand and failed.
"Amos, bring some pliers and a lot of patch cabling."
"So, no on the distress call, then?" Naomi said.
"No, but if someone could point a camera aft and reassure me that for all this trouble we actually killed that damn thing, that would be just swell."
"Watched it go myself, Cap," Alex said. "Nothing but gas now."
Holden lay on one of the sick bay beds, letting the ship look his leg over. Periodically, a manipulator prodded his knee, which was swelled up to the size of a cantaloupe. The skin stretched tight as a drum's head.
But the bed was also making sure to keep him perfectly medicated, so the occasional pokes and prods registered only as pressure, without any pain. The panel next to his head warned him to remain still. Then two arms grabbed his leg while a third injected a needle-thin, flexible tube into his knee and started doing something arthroscopic. He felt a vague tugging sensation. At the next bed over lay Prax. His head was bandaged where a 3-centimeter flap of skin had been glued back down. His eyes were closed. Amos, who had turned out not to have a concussion, just another nasty bump on his head, was below decks doing makeshift repairs on everything the monster's bomb had broken, including putting a temporary patch on the hole in their engineering bulkhead. They wouldn't be able to fix the cargo bay door until they docked at Tycho. Alex was flying them there at a gentle quarter G to make it easier to work. Holden didn't mind the delay. The truth was, he was in no hurry to get back to Tycho and confront Fred about what he'd seen. The longer he thought about it, the further he got from his earlier blind panic. And the more he thought Naomi was right. It made no sense for Fred to be behind any of this. But he wasn't sure, and he had to be sure. Prax mumbled something and touched his head. He started pulling on the bandages. "I wouldn't mess with those," Holden said. Prax nodded and closed his eyes again, sleeping or trying to. The auto doc pulled the tube out of Holden's leg, sprayed it with antiseptic, and began wrapping it with a tight bandage. Holden waited until the medical pod was done doing whatever it was doing to his knee, then turned sideways on the bed and tried to stand up. Even at a quarter G, his leg wouldn't support him. He hopped on one foot over to a supply locker and got himself a crutch. As he moved past the botanist's bed, Prax grabbed his arm. His grip was surprisingly strong. "It's dead?" "Yeah," Holden said, patting his hand. "We got it. Thanks." Prax didn't reply. He just rolled onto his side and shook. It took Holden a moment to realize Prax was weeping. He left without saying anything else. What else was there to say? Holden took the ladder lift up, planning to go to ops and read the detailed damage reports Naomi and the Rossi were compiling. He stopped when he got to the personnel deck and heard two people speaking. He couldn't hear what they were saying, but he recognized Naomi's voice, and he recognized the tone she used when she was having an intimate conversation. The voices were coming from the galley. Feeling a little like a peeping Tom, Holden moved closer to the galley hatch until he could make out the words. "It's more than that," Naomi was saying. Holden almost walked into the galley, but something in her tone stopped him. He had the terrible feeling she was talking about him. About them. About why she was leaving.
"Why does it have to be more?" the other person said. "Amos.
You almost beat a man to death with a can of chicken on Ganymede," Naomi replied.
"Gonna hold a little girl hostage for some food? Fuck him. If he was here, I'd smash him again right now."
"Do you trust me, Amos?" Naomi said. Her voice was sad. More than that. Frightened.
"More than anyone else," Amos replied.
"I'm scared out of my wits. Jim is rushing off to do something really dumb on Tycho. This guy we're taking with us seems like he's one twitch from a nervous breakdown."
"Well, he's..."
"And you," she continued. "I depend on you. I know you've always got my back no matter what. Except, maybe not now. Because the Amos I know doesn't beat a skinny kid half to death no matter how much chicken he asks for. I feel like everyone's losing themselves. I need to understand because I'm really, really frightened." Holden felt the urge to go in, take her hand, hold her. The need in her voice demanded it, but he held himself back. There was a long pause. Holden heard a scraping sound followed by the sound of metal hitting glass. Someone was stirring sugar into coffee. The sounds were so clear he could almost see it. So, Baltimore, Amos said, his voice as relaxed as if he were going to talk about the weather. Not a nice town. You ever heard of squeezing? Squeeze trade? Hooker squeeze? No, is it a drug? No, Amos said with a laugh. No, when you squeeze a hooker, you put her on the street until she gets knocked up, then peddle her to Johns who get off on pregnant girls, then send her back to the streets after she pops the kid. With procreation restrictions, banging pregnant girls is quite the kink. Squeeze? Yeah, you know, squeezing out puppies. You never heard it called that? Okay, Naomi said, trying to hide her disgust. Those kids? They're illegal, but they don't just vanish. Not right away, Amos continued. They got uses, too. Holden felt his chest tighten a little. It wasn't something he'd ever thought about. When, a second later, Naomi spoke, her horror echoed his. Jesus. Jesus got nothing to do with it, Amos said. No Jesus in the squeeze trade. But some kids wind up in the pimp gangs. Some wind up on the streets. Some wind up finding a way to ship off world and they never go back? Naomi asked, her voice quiet. Maybe, Amos said, his voice as flat and conversational as ever. Maybe some do. But most of them just disappear, eventually. Used up. Most of them. For a time, no one spoke. Holden heard the sounds of coffee being drunk. Amos, she said, her voice thick. I never... So, I'd like to find this little girl before someone uses her up, and she disappears. I'd like to do that for her, Amos said. His voice caught for a moment, and he cleared it with a loud cough. For her dad. Holden thought they were done, and started to slip away when he heard Amos, his voice calm again, say, Then, I'm gonna kill whoever snatched her. Chapter 30. Bobby. Prior to working for Avasarala at the UN, Bobby had never even heard of Mao Kwiatkowski Mercantile. Or, if she had, she hadn't noticed. She'd spent her whole life wearing, eating, or sitting on products carted through the solar system by Mao Quick freighters without ever realizing it. After she'd gone through the files Avasarala had given her, she'd been astonished at the size and reach of the company. Hundreds of ships, dozens of stations, millions of employees. Jules-Pierre Mao owned significant properties on every habitable planet and moon in the solar system. His 18-year-old daughter had owned her own racing ship, and that was the daughter he didn't like. When Bobby tried to imagine being so wealthy you could own a spaceship just to compete in races, she failed. That the same girl had run away to be an OPA rebel probably said a lot about the relationship of wealth and contentment, but Bobby had a hard time being that philosophical. She'd grown up solidly Martian middle class. Her father had done 20 as a marine non-com and had gone into private security consulting after he'd left the Corps. Bobby's family had always had a nice home. She and her two older brothers had attended a private primary school, and her brothers had both gone on to university without having to take out student loans. Growing up, she'd never once thought of herself as poor. She did now. Owning your own racing ship wasn't even wealth. It was like speciation. It was conspicuous consumption befitting ancient Earth royalty. A pharaoh's pyramid with a reaction drive. Bobby had thought it was the most ridiculous excess she'd ever heard of. And then she climbed off the short flight shuttle onto Jules-Pierre Mao's private L5 station. Jules didn't park his ships in orbit at a public station. He didn't even use a Mao Quick corporate station. This was an entire fully functioning space station in orbit around Earth solely for his private spaceships.
and the whole thing done up like peacock feathers. It was a level of extravagance that had never even occurred to her. She also thought it made Mao himself very dangerous. Everything he did was an announcement of his freedom from constraint. He was a man without boundaries. Killing a senior politician of the UN government might be bad business. It might wind up being expensive. But it would never actually be risky to a man with this much wealth and power. Avasarala didn't see it. "I hate spin gravity," Avasarala said, sipping at a cup of steaming tea. They'd been on the station for only 3 hours while cargo was transferred from the shuttle to Mao's yacht, but they'd been assigned a suite of 4 full-sized bedrooms, each with its own shower and a massive lounge area. A huge screen pretended to be a window. The crescent Earth with her continent-veiling clouds hung on the black. They had a private kitchen, staffed by 3 people whose biggest task so far had been making the assistant undersecretary's tea. Bobby considered ordering a large meal just to give them something to do. "I can't believe we're about to climb on a ship owned by this man. Have you ever known anyone this wealthy to go to jail? Or even be prosecuted? This guy could probably walk in here and shoot you in the face on a live news feed and get away with it." Avasarala laughed at her. Bobby suppressed a surge of anger. It was just fear looking for an outlet. "That's not the game," Avasarala said. "No one gets shot. They get marginalized. It's worse." "No, it's not. I've seen people shot. I've seen my friends shot. When you say, that's not the game, you mean for people like you, not like me." Avasarala's expression cooled. "Yes, that's what I mean," the old woman said. "The level we're playing at has different rules. It's like playing Go. It's all about exerting influence, controlling the board without occupying it." "Poker is a game too," Bobby said. "But sometimes the stakes get so high that one player decides it's easier to kill the other guy and walk away with the money. That happens all the time." Avasarala nodded at her, not replying right away, visibly thinking over what Bobby had said. Bobby felt her anger replaced with a sudden rush of affection for the grumpy and arrogant old lady. "Okay," Avasarala said, putting her teacup down and placing her hands in her lap. "I hear what you're saying, Sergeant. I think it's unlikely, but I'm glad you're here to say it." "But you aren't taking it seriously," Bobby wanted to shout at her. Instead, she asked the servant who hovered nearby for a mushroom and onion sandwich. While she ate it, Avasarala sipped tea, nibbled on a cookie, and made small talk about the war and her grandchildren. Bobby tried to be sure to make concerned noises during the war parts and aw cute noises when the kids were the topic. But all she could think about was the tactical nightmare defending Avasarala on an enemy-controlled spacecraft would be. Her recon suit was in a large crate marked formal wear and being loaded onto the Mao yacht even as they waited. Bobby wanted to sneak off and put it on. She didn't notice when Avasarala stopped speaking for several minutes. "Bobby," Avasarala said, her face not quite a frown, "are my stories about my beloved grandchildren boring you?"
"Yeah," Bobby replied. "They really are."
Bobby had thought that Mao Station was the most ludicrous display of conspicuous wealth she'd ever seen, right up until they boarded the yacht. While the station was extravagant, it at least served a function. It was Jules Mao's personal orbital garage where he could store and service his fleet of private spacecraft. Underneath the glitz, there was a working station with mechanics and support staff doing actual jobs. The yacht, the Guasha Yin, was the size of a standard cheap jack people mover that would have transported 200 customers. But it only had a dozen staterooms. Its cargo area was just large enough to contain the supplies they'd need for a lengthy voyage. It wasn't particularly fast.
It was, by any reasonable measurement, a miserable failure as a useful spacecraft. But its job was not to be useful. The Guasha Yin's job was to be comfortable. Extravagantly comfortable. It was like a hotel lobby. The carpet was plush and soft underfoot, and actual crystal chandeliers caught the light. Every place that should have had a sharp corner was rounded, softened. The walls were papered with raw bamboo and natural fiber. The first thing Bobby thought was how hard it would be to clean, and the second thing was that the difficulty was intentional. Each suite of rooms took up nearly an entire deck of the ship. Each room had its own private bath, media center, game room, and lounge with a full bar. The lounge had a gigantic screen showing the view outside, which would not have been higher definition had it been an actual glass window. Near the bar was a dumbwaiter next to an intercom, which could deliver food prepared by Cordon Bleu chefs any hour of the day or night. The carpet was so thick, Bobby was pretty sure mag boots wouldn't work. It wouldn't matter. A ship like this would never break down, never have to stop the engines during flight. The kind of people who flew on the Guansha Yin had probably never actually worn an environment suit in their lives. All the fixtures in her bathroom were gold-plated. Bobby and Avasarala were sitting in the lounge with the head of her UN security team, a pleasant-looking gray-haired man of Kurdish descent named Kotyar. Bobby had been worried when she first met him. He looked like a friendly high school teacher, not a soldier. But then she'd watched him go through Avasarala's rooms with practice deficiency, laying out their security plan and directing his team, and her worries eased. "Well, impressions?" Avasarala asked, leaning back in a plush armchair with her eyes closed. "This room is not secure," Kotyar said, his accent exotic to Bobby's ears. "We should not discuss sensitive matters here. Your private room has been secured for such discussions." "This is a trap," Bobby said. "Aren't we finished with that shit yet?" Avasarala said, then leaned forward to give Bobby a glare. "She is right," Kotyar said quietly, clearly unhappy to be discussing such matters in an unsecured room. "I've counted 14 crew on this ship already, and I would estimate that is less than one-third of the total crew of this vessel. I have a team of 6 for your protection." 7, Bobby interrupted, raising her hand. "As you say," Kotyar continued with a nod. 7. "We do not control any of the ship's systems. Assassination would be as simple as sealing the deck we are on and pumping out the air." Bobby pointed at Kotyar and said, "See?" Avasarala waved a hand as if she were shooing flies. "What's communications look like?" "Robust," Kotyar said. "We've set up a private network and have been given the backup tight beam and radio array for your personal use. Bandwidth is significant, though light delay will be an increasing factor as we move away from Earth." "Good," Avasarala said, smiling for the first time since they'd come on the ship. She'd stopped looking tired a while ago, and had moved on to whatever tired turns into when it became a lifestyle. "None of this is secure," Kotyar said. "We can secure our private internal network, but if they are monitoring outbound and inbound traffic through the array we're using, there will be no way to detect that. We have no access to ship operations." "And," Avasarala said, "that is exactly why I'm here. Bottle me up, send me on a long trip, and read all my fucking mail." "We're lucky if that's all they do," Bobby said. Thinking about how tired Avasarala looked had reminded her how tired she was, too. She felt herself drift away for a moment. Avasarala finished saying something, and Kotyar nodded and said yes to her. She turned to Bobby and said, "Do you agree?" Bobby said, trying to rewind the conversation in her head and failing. "You're practically falling out of your fucking chair. When's the last time you got a full night's sleep?" Probably about the last time you did, Bobby said. The last time all my squatties were alive and you weren't trying to keep the solar system from catching on fire, she thought. She waited for the next scathing comment, the next observation that she couldn't do her job if she was that compromised, that weak. Fair enough, Avasarala said. Bobby felt another little surge of affection for her. Mao's throwing a big dinner tonight to welcome us aboard. I want you and Kotya to come with. Kotya will be security, so he'll stand at the back of the room and look menacing. Bobby laughed before she could stop herself. Kotya smiled and winked at her. And, Avasarala continued, you'll be there as my social secretary, so you can chat people up. Try to get a feel for the crew and the mood of the ship, okay? Roger that. I noticed, Avasarala said, her tone shifting to the one she used when she was going to ask for an unpleasant favor, the executive officer staring at you when we did the airlock meet and greet. Bobby nodded. She'd noticed it too. Some men had a large woman fetish, and Bobby had gotten the hair-raising sense that he might be a member of that tribe. They tended to have unresolved mommy issues, so she generally steered clear. Any chance you could talk him up at dinner? Avasarala finished. Bobby laughed, expecting everyone else to laugh too. Even Kotyar was looking at her as though Avasarala had made a perfectly reasonable request. No, Bobby said. Did you say no? Yeah, no. Hell no. Fuck no. Nein und abermals nein. Niet. La. Sie. Bobby said, stopping when she ran out of languages. And I'm actually a little pissed now. I'm not asking you to sleep with him. Good, because I don't use sex as a weapon, Bobby said. I use weapons as weapons. Christian, Jules Mao said, enveloping Avasarala's hand in his and shaking it. The lord of the Mao Quick Empire towered over Avasarala. He had the kind of handsome face that made Bobby instinctively want to like him, and medically untreated male pattern hair loss that said he didn't care whether she did. Choosing not to use his wealth to fix a problem as treatable as thinning hair actually made him seem even more in control. He wore a loose sweater and cotton pants that hung on him like a tailored suit. When Avasarala introduced Bobby to him, he smiled and nodded while barely glancing in her direction. Is your stuff settled in? He asked, letting Avasarala know that Bobby's presence reminded him of underlings. Bobby gritted her teeth but kept her face blank. Yes, Avasarala replied with what Bobby would have sworn was genuine warmth. The accommodations are lovely, and your crew has been wonderful. Excellent, Jules said, placing Avasarala's hand on his arm and leading her to an enormous table. They were surrounded on all sides by men in white jackets and black bow ties. One of them darted forward and pulled a chair out. Jules placed Avasarala in it. Chef Marco has promised something special tonight. How about straight answers? Are those on the menu? Bobby asked as a waiter pulled out a chair for her. Jules settled into his chair at the head of the table. Answers? You guys won, Bobby said, ignoring the steaming soup one of the servers placed in front of her. Mao tapped salt onto his and began eating it as though they were just having casual dinner conversation. The assistant undersecretary is on the ship. No reason to bullshit us now. What's going on? Humanitarian aid, he replied. Bullshit, Bobby said. She glanced at Avasarala, but the old woman was just smiling. You can't tell me that you have time to spend a couple of months doing the transit to Jupiter just to oversee handing out rice and juice boxes. And you couldn't get enough relief supplies onto this ship to feed Ganymede lunch, much less make a long-term difference. Mao settled back in his chair, and the white jackets bustled around the room, clearing the soup away. Bobby's was whisked away as well. even though she hadn't eaten any of it. "Roberta," Mao began.
"Don't call me Roberta."
"Sergeant, you should be questioning your superiors at the UN Foreign Office, not me."
"I'd love to, but apparently asking questions is against the rules in this game."
His smile was warm, condescending, and empty.
"I made my ship available to provide Madam Undersecretary the most comfortable ride to her new assignment. And, while you have not yet met them, there are personnel currently on this vessel whose expertise will be invaluable to the citizens of Ganymede once you arrive."
Bobby had been around Avasarala long enough to see the game being played right in front of her. Mao was laughing at her. He knew this was all bullshit, and he knew she knew it as well. But as long as he remained calm and gave reasonable answers, no one could call him on it. He was too powerful to be called a liar to his face.
"You're a liar, and..." she started. Then something he'd said made her stop.
"Wait, once you arrive, you aren't coming?"
"I'm afraid not," Mao said, smiling up at the white jacket who placed another plate in front of him. This one had what appeared to be a whole fish, complete with head and staring eyes.
Bobby gaped at Avasarala, who was frowning at Mao now.
"I was told you were personally leading this relief effort," Avasarala said.
"That was my intention, but I'm afraid other business has removed that option. Once we finish with this excellent dinner, I'll be taking the shuttle back to the station. This ship and its crew are at your disposal until your vital work on Ganymede is complete."
Avasarala just stared at Mao.
For the first time in Bobby's experience, the old lady was struck speechless. A white jacket brought Bobby a fish, while her lush prison flew at a leisurely quarter G toward Jupiter. Avasarala hadn't said a word on the ride down the lift to their suite. In the lounge, she stopped long enough to grab a bottle of gin off the bar and waggled a finger at Bobby. Bobby followed her into the master bedroom, Kotyar close behind. Once the door was closed and Kotyar had used his handheld security terminal to scan the room for bugs, Avasarala said, "Bobby, start thinking of a way to either get control of this ship or get us off of it."
"Forget that," Bobby said. "Let's go grab that shuttle Mao's leaving on right now. It's within range of his station, or he wouldn't be taking it."
To her surprise, Kotyar nodded.
"I agree with the sergeant. If we plan to leave, the shuttle will be easier to commandeer and control against a hostile crew."
Avasarala sat down on her bed with a long exhale that turned into a heavy sigh.
"I can't leave yet. It doesn't work that way."
"The fucking game," Bobby yelled.
"Yes," Avasarala snapped.
"Yes, the fucking game. I've been ordered by my superiors to make this trip. If I leave now, I'm out. They'll be polite and call it a sudden illness or exhaustion, but the excuse they give me will also be the reason I'm not allowed to keep doing my job. I'll be safe, and I'll be powerless. As long as I pretend I'm doing what they asked me to, I can keep working. I'm still the Assistant Undersecretary of Executive Administration. I still have connections, influence. If I run now, I lose them. If I lose them, these fuckers might as well shoot me."
"But," Bobby said,
"but," Avasarala repeated,